Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Here are two people who President Trump finds equally credible on whether the Russian government tried to illegally interfere in the 2016 election. Vladimir Putin, head of the Russian state, and Dan Coats, former Republican senator from Indiana, Trump's own appointee as director of national intelligence. Here's Coats just before the summit.
Well, my message would be, we know what you're doing. And we know you know what you're doing. But, you know, President Putin, the decisions are up to you. We know you run the shop. We know you're making the decisions. You can't pass it off to, oh, that's some hacker down somewhere where we don't know. We know what you do. And so you make the choice. But if you want to stay in this tit for tat, we're going to beat you.
Well, that was pretty clear. Dan Coats, President Trump's handpicked director of national intelligence just before the summit. And here's Trump just after the summit.
My people came to me, Dan Coats came to me and some others. They said they think it's Russia. I have President Putin. He just said it's not Russia. I will say this. I don't see any reason why it would be, but I really do want to see the server. But I have confidence in both parties.
I have confidence in both parties, Dan Coats and Vladimir Putin. That's the mind-boggling moral equivalency that Trump says he now buys into. Speaker of the House Paul Ryan doesn't, by the way. He said, quote, yesterday, there is no moral equivalence between the United States and Russia, which remains hostile to our most basic values and ideas. Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, said a similar thing. The Russians are not our friends. I've said that repeatedly. I say it again today. And I have complete confidence in our intelligence community and the findings that they have announced. Those quotes were in the Times this morning. And even some Fox News anchors aren't buying it. Like Neil Cavuto, the prime anchor, one of the prime anchors on the Fox Business Channel, who called it disgusting. He used that word. That the president didn't look Putin in the eye and say he would be punished for all this.
And that's what made it disgusting. That's what made his performance disgusting. I'm sorry, it's just the only way I feel. It's not a right or left thing to me, it's just wrong.
Neil Cavuto, some people go further than disgusting and just wrong. The debate is now on about whether to call the president's remarks treasonous, as Thomas Friedman does today in his New York Times column, and as former CIA director John Brennan does today. The debate does not seem to be as on among Republicans about what to do about the president of the United States defending Russia against virtually the entire rest of what the U.S. government thinks. What will Mitch McConnell or Paul Ryan or other Republicans do to protect America, potentially from our own president now, if he is now putting Russian interests first above American election integrity, and if he is making America weak again in relation to Vladimir Putin? Even the front page headline in the New York Post this morning, if you don't read that online, did you see it on a newsstand? The New York Post, owned by Rupert Murdoch, just like the Fox News Channel, the front page of the Post shouts, "See no evil. Prez gives big bear hug to wicked BFF Vlad. Jabs U.S. intel." That's the cover of the Post. With me next is Heather Hurlburt, former White House and State Department official under Bill Clinton, now a columnist at New York Magazine's Daily Intelligencer and director of the New Models of Policy Change program at the progressive think tank New America. She has a New York Magazine article today, 7 takeaways from Trump's catastrophic meeting with Putin. Thanks for coming on, Heather. Welcome back to WNYC.
Someday you're going to have me on when something good happens, Brian.
I promise. When something good happens that's in your wheelhouse, we will have you on. You wrote that every element of the summit was predictable. Did you think Trump would go that far to diss his own national intelligence director and equate, he didn't diss Dan Coats, but he did equate Putin's credibility with that of Dan Coats, saying the exact opposite thing? Did you actually predict he would go that far?
No. That was the one surprising element of the thing to me, that it was completely predictable that Trump would not call for the extradition of the Russians who've been indicted for trying to fix our elections. It was completely predictable that Trump would not have as good a grasp of the substance as Putin would. It was completely predictable that Putin would use the occasion to sort of present himself as a top-tier world power and fully Trump's equal in terms of economic military power. It was pretty predictable that Putin would present himself as a head of an alternative political system to liberal democracy, the way we're used to thinking about it in the West. I figured that Trump might not acquit himself the way I would like a president of any party to acquit her or himself, but no, it didn't really occur to me that Trump would use that stage to undercut the legitimacy of not just U.S. intelligence, but also U.S. law enforcement. Let's not forget, you know, the people who did those indictments. So Trump was basically undercutting the intel establishment and the FBI, and that, no, I did not predict that.
One of your seven takeaways is that on closer inspection, Putin made no commitments at all at the summit. Were there commitments he seemed to make?
If you listened to particularly the beginning of the press availability, he seemed to go very far towards saying, we will start nuclear arms control negotiations again, and we will work with the U.S. and Israel to ensure Israel's security where Iranian-backed forces in Syria have been launching assaults on the Israeli-Syrian border, and Israel was very eager for Russia to play a role in restraining Iran. Now, just between you, me, and the listeners, it's not totally clear that Russia could restrain Iranian-backed forces even if it wanted to, but Putin appeared to promise that that would happen. And a reporter point-blank asked Trump later on, what are the details on that? And Trump, both men, just totally passed over the question. It became very obvious that there weren't any. This is totally predictable, by the way. This is very reminiscent of the North Korea summit last month, where Trump goes in without sufficient preparation, doesn't allow the experienced professionals on the White House and State Department staff to do background documents, to do agreements, and so just gets in there and does whatever he does in the one-on-ones, which I hope we'll find out about when the interpreters write their memoirs, and then comes out and, you know, it's like, I know nothing about how real estate deals are done, but it seems, you know, at some point at the end of a real estate negotiation, you do have a contract. But in Trump's summit process, there's never a contract. There's never anything other than his tweets that you can hold him to.
So you're saying look for these nice words that Putin had about protecting Israeli security from Iranian incursion, basically from across the Syrian border, where there's so much Iranian military support for Assad and chaos internally in Syria. Look for those words to be just words.
Yep. And do not look for nuclear arms control to resume anytime soon, even though, as I say, that is a nonpartisan concern and we should always be engaged in managing and limiting our nuclear relationship with Russia, no matter who's president, no matter who else is going on. I was in favor of there being a meeting with the hope that it would produce a return to talks and progress on the nuclear front, but nothing came out of that that will give, again, that would give the professionals on both sides something to go on to actually put together a process.
And what you wrote on the magazine, New York Magazine site on this today was very interesting. You wrote, Putin touted the nuclear arms agenda, but Trump scarcely mentioned it. And then you give us some background. John Bolton, in particular, has long been an opponent of arms control. He's the National Security Advisor. And Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is also on the record in favor of expanding the nuclear arsenal. So can you put that in the context of this meeting and of Trump administration nuclear policy?
Well, you know, the New Yorker's Susan Glasser, in a piece the day before the summit, quoted some insiders saying that they had never seen such a dysfunctional and poorly prepared process. So the fact of the matter is right now that the U.S. government is not fielding a national security team that would actually be able to undertake anything as serious as nuclear negotiations. And that's partly because of sheer incompetence, but also because, as you correctly spell out, core members of the Trump team don't agree. And you saw the divisions you saw in conservative media after the summit yesterday. You have a swath of the Republican Party that likes the idea of a closer relationship with Russia and that coincidentally likes the idea of slowing or stopping the post 9/11 military buildup. That is not the traditional conservative national security establishment, which wants to confront Russia with everything we have. And by the way, confront every other opponent simultaneously with everything we have, which has helped get us into some of the issues we now face. So both of those factions are represented in the Trump administration. And a normal president, you know, may have opposing views in his or her cabinet, but then makes clear decisions, lays down the law, and then normal cabinet officers follow the president's decisions, where you have this president, remember, saying, it's been reported, that he wanted the one-on-one meeting so that he could be sure that his own cabinet members, his own advisors, didn't interrupt him or contradict him. Now, I worked in the White House for Bill Clinton. I also worked in the State Department and on delegations while George H.W. Bush was president. And I got to tell you, neither of them was ever afraid that their advisors would contradict them. That is such an incredibly dysfunctional process and dysfunctional leadership. Again, totally apart from partisan views on the matter.
Of course, we don't want Trump's aides to contradict him when he says something we agree with. We do want his aides to contradict him when he says things like Vladimir Putin is right and our national security establishment is wrong. So if your larger point on all the details we've been talking about is that Putin made no commitments at all at the summit, did Trump make any commitments?
Well, you know, there's really no reason for any foreign interlocutor to take any of Trump's promises particularly seriously. So if I were a Russian foreign policy expert, if I were one of Putin's advisors, I would be looking at the public record and saying, okay, how can we try to box him into a corner? But what we don't know, Brian, is what he said privately. And, you know, this is the other problem with one-on-one meetings with no note takers. It's the problem with the White House that doesn't release summaries, that doesn't release outcomes. I have no idea what the president may have committed to in private. And that means when Moscow may claim that Putin said something in private, that Trump said something in private, I'm not going to know. You're not going to know.
And it's one of the reasons that a caller in an earlier segment today asked a legal affairs expert if the translator could be subpoenaed by the Mueller investigation to see what Trump was really promising to Putin. Unfortunately, the answer is probably no, unless there's reason to suspect something. Another of your takeaways, and my guest is Heather Hurlburt, former Clinton and H.W. Bush administration official, who's with New America now and with New York Magazine. She has an article today, 7 Takeaways from Trump's Catastrophic Meeting with Putin. Another of your takeaways, despite everything we've been saying about Putin having the upper hand, is that Putin may still have overplayed his hand. How so?
Well, in two ways.
Do you need a break? You know what? We're going to take a break during this segment anyway. Let's take it right now. You can clear your throat and then come back and we'll hear the answer to that question and more. We'll also play a clip of Barack Obama, who tries not to comment on what Trump does. He said something about Trump at a ceremony in South Africa today. We'll play the Obama clip and continue with Heather Hurlburt and your calls right after this. Brian Lehrer on WNYC as we continue with foreign policy expert Heather Hurlburt and her 7 takeaways from Trump's catastrophic meeting with Putin, as the headline is on the New York Magazine website. She wrote that article today. And, you know, past presidents try to be very restrained when it comes to commenting in real time on things that the current president is doing. But after that catastrophic or mind-boggling or eye-popping or whatever you want to call it news conference after the summit yesterday, former President Barack Obama said this, speaking at the Nelson Mandela Annual Lecture in Johannesburg, South Africa today.
Given the strange and uncertain times that we are in, and they are strange, and they are uncertain, with each day's news cycles bringing more head-spinning and disturbing headlines.
Well, I guess he could have said that on practically any day in the last year and a half, but he chose to actually say it out loud yesterday, probably because of the summit and the news conference. So, Heather, you were starting to say before the break how even as everybody is saying that, Trump was kind of playing second fiddle to Putin when he tries not to look like he's playing second fiddle to anybody else most of the time, even as the protests that spontaneously broke out outside the White House upon his return yesterday was people chanting, puppet, puppet, you're the puppet, that you think, even with all of that, that Putin overplayed his hand. How so?
So that clip you just played is such a great example of a leader really carefully weighing his words. And you can just hear Obama thinking, how far should I go here? How long should I pause so it's clear to everyone what I'm talking about without actually speaking the word? And two things that happened in that press conference were interesting, that Putin's prepared statement was very much intended to set him out as the above it all world leader with a sort of larger vision and not caught up in little petty things. And he's famously disciplined, of course. But at a certain point, when the reporters had been really pushing Trump on the allegations around the 2016 campaign, Putin came back to the mic when he didn't have to and launched into a really defensive defense of himself. Actually, the Russian translator was staggering over himself to try to find the words because Putin was speaking so quickly and so defensively. And that was striking to me. That part of the event won't get played for Russian audiences, so I wouldn't overstate its impact. But if you watched that part of it, Putin was definitely in protesting too much mode. And the other thing he did, which has been picked up on considerably, was when he was asked, did you want Trump to win and did you help him? Putin said, yes, yes, I did, because I thought he would restore U.S.-Russian relations, which, number one, was unclear which part of the question he was answering. And number two, it was the first time that he's explicitly said, yes, I wanted Trump to win, which some writers and some Russia experts have really been treating as a major tell. So I think it's just a reminder to everyone that Putin is not invincible. Let's not make him bigger than he is. And let's make sure to focus on what are the right things to counter this that we can be doing at home rather than make Putin into this giant, undefeatable boogeyman, which he's really not.
Why do you think it was such a tell or so significant in any way for Putin to acknowledge in the news conference that he wanted Trump to win rather than Hillary Clinton? That's certainly not an admission that he had his military agents hack Democratic Party computers and strategically release information, as Mueller has charged them with, to actually help Trump win the election. But it's pretty clear in a lot of cases when you look at the basic international lines of geopolitics, who one country might want to win in another country's election in many, many cases. Anybody probably could have guessed that Vladimir Putin wanted Donald Trump to win. So why was it newsworthy yesterday when he said that out loud?
Yeah, it was clear in 2016 and even in 2015 that Putin had a deep personal resentment toward Clinton that he felt humiliated by her. So, no, it's not news in any way, but it was rather remarkable that Trump earlier in the same event had said, no, of course he didn't want me to win. He probably preferred Hillary. So to watch the two of them contradict each other was rather strange, as Obama just said. And again, it's where Putin has been so very, very, very disciplined about not wading into this whole area and really, frankly, letting his information operation play out exactly as it's designed to, which is rather than Russia directly attacking the U.S. in any way, we attack and destroy ourselves by fighting about this kind of thing internally. And of course, for Putin's purposes, which is not just to weaken the U.S., but also to weaken the appeal of liberal government anywhere in the world, it's much more effective if we appear to be doing it to ourselves, which in fact we are. So for Putin to kind of climb down off his pedestal and start to wade into it himself is an interesting development.
I want to get into with you in a few minutes that larger question of the threat of all this to liberal democracy here and around the world. But first, let me take a follow-up question from a listener, 212-433-WNYC, with foreign policy analyst Heather Hurlburt. And Jay in Bergen County, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jay.
Yes. I wanted to say that initially when I heard from Trump that he, took Putin's word over our own intelligence agencies, I found that upsetting. But, you know, could this just be an example of keep our friends close but our enemies closer? And maybe, you know, I'm not sure what we have to gain by calling him out to be this evil actor publicly, besides just electrifying, our own base and Americans. Maybe Trump wants to get something done. Maybe he wants a positive relationship with Putin so he could actually get some gain out of that relationship.
Heather?
Well, Jay, I actually, and this stance is not hugely popular in the national security community, but I agree with you that it's kind of a waste of oxygen to spend a lot of time saying, oh, you should send the indicted intelligence agents to the U.S. You know, Trump is never going to do that. I mean, I'm sorry, Putin's never going to do that. So I, up to a point, agree with you that there's a limit to how much chest beating is useful on this topic. And I also agree with you, as I said earlier, that the U.S. needs to have a channel of communication and a productive relationship with Russia where we work together on things that we have in common. Now, the trouble with your theory is that, like I said, there's no evidence of anything concrete, any follow-up, any agreements, any commitments having come out of this meeting that would actually sort of lead us in a productive direction. So, you know, number one, I just, with great regret, in a nonpartisan way, I just deeply regret that this government does not appear up to pursuing cooperation with Russia where we should be cooperating. And at the same time, you know, the president is the boss of the intelligence community and the boss of the law enforcement community. And it's not all right to trash the work of your employees to ingratiate yourself with a foreign leader. That's just fundamentally how we don't elect our presidents to do that to any kind of federal workers, whether it's intelligence workers, whether it's the military, whether it's law enforcement, or frankly, whether it's teachers or anybody. So no, I wish I thought this was that strategic.
To follow up on Jay's question for a minute, and Jay, thank you for your call. There is, I mean, you work at a progressive think tank, New America. There is a progressive line of thinking. We had the Nation's editor and publisher, Katrina Vandenhoevel, on yesterday, who spearheaded a letter signed by all these progressive luminaries, Michael Moore, Reverend Barber, Alice Walker. I'm not even thinking of all the policy, mostly older policy heavyweights who were in that, Noam Chomsky, all these folks who were saying, look, what Russia did to our elections appears to be real, but this demonizing of Russia has a certain mindless Cold War, I'm putting this in my own words, mindless Cold War kind of aura about it where, you know, the U.S. national security and military establishment has been so aggressive in the world for so many decades from a progressive point of view, and NATO, which suddenly the left loves to love, has been aggressive in pushing Russia into a corner and helping to create the current post-Cold War enmity. And let's not go crazy here. Let's not lose our mind saying villain, villain, villain to Russia beyond what's actually real. Do you agree with any of that?
So really attentive listeners of your program will remember that I debated Ms. VandenHeuvel on Russia on this program a couple years back, just a moment to give Brian's archives a plug. And I have huge respect for some of the folks you named who, you know more and have risked more in their respective fields than I ever have. Oh, I also need to say New America is a nonpartisan institution. We are not politically aligned. I have colleagues who are right of center. I have colleagues who are left of center. I have colleagues who kind of float unconnected to what we think of as a left-right axis. So okay. let me get that out of the way. Totally agree with the construct that mindless demonizing of Putin isn't useful. I would also add that seamlessly connecting Putin and Russia as if they're the same thing is not useful. Like I've already said several times, we need to have, any U.S. government needs to have open communications with Russia, needs to be able to work together with Russia, needs above all to manage our nuclear arsenals together in a way that's good for the security of our citizens and everybody. So yeah, there's a level of demonization that is too much and that is problematic, and I would argue potentially distracts us from facing up to, you know, why were those silly emails, silly fake Facebook accounts, why were they able to shift the results of an election? That's not on Putin, that's on us. So agree with all of that. Totally disagree generally with Ms. VandenHeuvel's take on what Russia policy should be. So it's possible to not demonize the Russian nation or the Russian people. It's possible to totally support, as I do, a constructive, engaged relationship with Russia, and to say, hey, when someone mounts a sustained attack on your electoral system, you know, hacks the Illinois state electoral process, by the way, I just want to remind everybody of that. It wasn't just the DNC. Poisons people in our closest ally, Britain, invades its neighbors. You know, those are all things worthy of a response if we want to continue to live in a world where rules matter and where basic norms of behavior in the UN Charter that we've all signed up to, including Russia, matter. So, can you over-demonize Putin? Yes, you definitely can. Is that what's happening right now? I'm a little more skeptical.
The one other thing I want to get to with you before you run out of time is, besides looking at your New York Magazine article today, I looked at your Twitter feed and I saw you tweeted an analysis of Putin's worldview from the American Interest magazine and why he inspires others in what the article calls globo skepticism. He's a globo skeptic. Is there a Putin doctrine you can explain? And to what you were starting to raise before, are there competing views even of what Western civilization is that come into play here? Well, let me leave the question there and let you answer it.
Yeah, thanks. So this is a terrific article in the American Interest by a Russian scholar and analyst named, I believe, Inozentsev. And so we've had over the years this very peculiar, on its face, phenomenon where right-wing, neo-Nazi, neo-Confederate hate groups in the U.S., in Western and Eastern Europe, align themselves with Russia. And frankly, look at Moscow and say, oh, hey, look, those people are white and they're Christian and they like authority. And the way the author puts it in this American Interest piece that sort of summarizes what connects these movements is majoritarian cultures who do not want to empower a form of democracy in which they perceive their cultural dominance to be threatened by minority cultures. And so that connects sort of the views of conservative Russians in a very multi-ethnic state, by the way, Russia is. We forget that often. Europeans struggling to deal with immigration and refugee flows over recent years. And, of course, the far right in the U.S. that we know. And there are very explicit links and partnerships among those groups. And you actually saw this play out in the press conference yesterday where seemingly randomly referred to George Soros. And you're thinking, well, why on earth would Putin bother to refer to George Soros? Because that is a dog whistle to the far right, anti-Semitic, white nationalists, both in Eastern Europe and in the U.S. I mean, literally, they're in Hungary. George Soros has been made into a national villain to justify just about any anti-democratic stance the government of Hungary wants to take. So Putin personally does not deserve any credit for this, so I don't call it a Putin doctrine. It's not something he did. But it is absolutely something that he sees and is able to use and is able to position Russia thus at the head of. So, hey, you like elections, you can have elections. You like open economy, you can have a sort of open economy. But we're not going to have any of this messy business of multiple groups contending for rights or standing in the culture, that the who has standing in the culture is going to come from the top down. And so that's sort of the international relations that you're not seeing when those two men stand up in front of us.
This is the question of our time, and we'll have to leave it here. But it's... what is Western civilization? Is it, and you were so clear in putting what the Putin and Trump view of it is, apparently this white, Christian, majoritarian, and authoritarian idea that doesn't sound like what a lot of Americans might think of as the idea of the West, but that's what they consider the idea of the West. Putin and Trump think they're saving Western civilization when they're really promoting that version of what they call Western civilization versus the George Soros version. And we think of Soros in the domestic context as just sort of supporting U.S. liberal and progressive causes. But you're right, around the world, what he's tried to use his money to do is to promote democracy in countries where that teeters, you know, meaning accountable institutions, an independent judiciary, protection of freedom of the press, protection of both ethnic and political minorities in countries as opposed to just majoritarian, you know, winner takes all and oppresses the minority in countries. That's the competing definition of the West. This is really the issue of our times. This is the question, fundamentally, that the Donald Trump presidency raises for America and the world, isn't it?
Yes. The only thing that we left out that I would add back in is that it all rests on a set of gender norms, which we don't often think. But it's all dependent on a kind of power being linked to a vision of masculinity, which, you know, all the kind of joking things that listeners may have seen of Putin riding horses bare-chested and so on. That's not accidental. This is all, in a funny way, this is what foreign policy is now, which is very odd for those of us who went to grad school to study arms control.
Heather Hurlburt with New America. She's the director of the New Models of Policy Change program there. She served in the George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton administrations, and she's a contributor to New York Magazine's Daily Intelligencer. She has an article today, 7 Takeaways from Trump's Catastrophic Meeting with Putin. Thank you so much, Heather.
Great to be here.